been nice to sit together in person again and have the thunderstorm and the wind chimes. So the title of my talk today is The Art of Meditation. And so we have the art of meditation and the science of meditation. And the Buddhist science of meditation goes back 2,500 years. And over that time, you know, different Buddhist traditions have done a lot of investigation of different meditation techniques and quite different in different traditions. So for instance, in the Tibetan tradition, there's a strong practice of visualizations. But also, if you're a serious meditator in the Tibetan tradition, it's quite customary to do a three-year solitary retreat, which is pretty intense. And some even do multiple retreats of those. But doing this practice in this way, they found a way of really cultivating very, very deep states of meditation. And then in the Theravadan tradition, there's jhana practice, so very deep states of absorption. And again, yeah, really quite remarkable ability to achieve very deep states of meditation. And in our tradition, we have the koan practice and shikantaza as well. So there's been the Buddhist science of meditation and looking at what's effective, what works. And then we also have the Western science of meditation. And again, that's really, in the last few years, found some really remarkable things as well, being able to watch people in, you know, brain and MRI scanners as they meditate and see what parts of the brains are activated, looking at brain structures and how they actually change as a result of meditation. So, yeah, there's a lot of knowledge about through the Buddhist practice and Western science about different techniques and what their work and what the practice of meditation can do. But of course, meditation is not just about techniques. There's another element to it as well. And if you look at the art, so for instance, if you're learning a musical instrument, again, there's many different traditions. So different cultures have different instruments, different techniques of learning it. There's a bit like meditation. There's a lot of practice, a lot of repetition. But then that sense of attainment, getting quite high level of skills, perhaps. But if you're going to a concert or you're listening to music and you're really carried away with the music, really emotionally touched by it, you're not really thinking about technique. There's something else going on. And it's actually not easy to put that into words, what's happening when we are engaged with an art form like music or other art forms as well. Sometimes I've read studies where, you know, it's said it's great for children to learn musical instrument because then they get they actually improve their English and their maths. And so that's a good reason for schools to have a music program. But if you go into a concert, you're listening to a musician play, you're not sort of thinking, oh, I wonder how the English and the maths is going. You know, there's something completely different going on. So, yeah, meditation can have outcomes. So we can become less reactive. We can choose our response to situations a bit more. We, over time, learn to regulate our emotional states and our arousal state. Perhaps get less caught up in mindless sort of addictive behaviors and make more choices. But there's still a sense, if you think about meditation in that way, that it's very outcome orientated, you know. So I'm doing this and then I'm getting this particular outcome. And if you're really focusing on that, it gives us a sense of control and efficacy that, you know, we're doing this practice and therefore we have some control over our lives. And this is what Barry Magid, who is also a teacher in Ordinary Mind Zen, calls the curative fantasy. So we do a practice and then we'll have a cure to the human condition, basically, as a result of the practice. So if I think about for myself, why do I meditate? And maybe that, you know, we could just spend a moment just reflecting individually, just, you know, why do I meditate? Just asking yourself that question for a moment. Why do I actually meditate? And And I think for me, if I ask myself that, I think, well, I don't really know why I meditate, except perhaps a slight sense of being a little bit more present. But it's almost a bit like listening to music. I don't know why I listen to music, but it's just something I do. So it's an interesting question to ask ourselves. So I've been reading this book by Oliver Berkerman called 4,000 Weeks, Time and How to Use It. So Oliver Berkerman is a writer. He's not a Buddhist teacher or psychologist, anything like that. But I found it a really fascinating book. And so he really talks about our lifespan is basically 4,000 weeks on average. So some people obviously get a lot less, some people get quite a bit more. But roughly we have 4,000 weeks of time, and then it's how do we use the time or how do we manage the time. So he talks a lot about, ideas of time management, efficient time management, making the best use of our time, making sure not wasting our lives. And the way we think about time, if we think about time in that, again, that sort of outcome-focused way, it can actually really be a trap that sort of leads us away from being present with time. And that leads us to all kinds of interesting little traps, which actually relate to some of the concepts in Buddhism as well that we have. So one of the things he talks about is that we are cosmically really insignificant. So we are one person out of about 7.9 billion people. So that's a lot of people, that's just us. We have about 4,000 weeks on this earth. And then of course in the concept of the age of the earth itself, that's billions of years, we're just a little tiny postscript there. And then there's a whole universe as well. So that sense of, if you really think about it, our lives are really quite insignificant. And that doesn't mean we're not important, but there's actually nothing particularly special about our lives. We do have some agency in our lives. So with the mind-body sort of therapies and making choices about how we live our lives, the figure that often comes up is that we have about 30% input into how our life develops. And of course it changes, depending on our circumstances, things like that. But a really strong component is our genetic inheritance. And again, we can, through our lifestyle choices and that, affect some of the gene expression, which ones are expressed and which are not. But the genes are still really strong in us. And then another huge part is our external circumstances. So the society we live in, our person's circumstances, things like that. And again, there's not much we can do about those. And then we have another part of that, which is about 30%, where we can make choices about what food we eat, what kind of relationships we cultivate with people around us, whether we meditate, exercise, and that. And 30% is not nothing, but it's certainly not 100%. And sometimes when we look at, some of the wellness movement or maybe more new age thinking, things like that, it's almost like, you've got 100% control, and it's certainly we don't have 100%. But we do have some input. But again, it's not that sort of 100%. He also talks about something that he calls provisional life. And he's got this quote here by Mary Louise von Franz, who's a Swiss psychologist and a scholar of fairy tales. And she wrote in 1970 about this sort of otherworldly atmosphere of existence that we might have. There's a strange attitude and feeling that one is not yet in real life. For the time being, one is doing this or that, but whether it is a relationship with a woman or a job, it is not yet what is really wanted. And there's always a fantasy that sometime in the future, the real thing will come about. The one thing dreaded throughout by such type of man, so this is gendered writing, is to be bound to anything whatever. There's a terrific fear of being pinned down, of entering space and time completely, and of being the unique human that one is. So that sense of entering space and time completely. And he also goes on to quote Joko Beck, that Zen teacher Joko Beck says, life, the human condition is often painful, but that's only unbearable for as long as we are under the impression that there might be a cure. Accept the inevitability of the affliction and freedom ensues. you can get on with living at last. And so it's a sense of, you know, we want to achieve things with our time, we want to manage it, we want to make the best use of it, or we can drop all of that and just enter into the flow of time and space completely and dropping our illusions and the curative fantasy. And I think this is well expressed by one of my favorite haikus by Matsuo Basho. It's just this. Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's cry, I long for Kyoto. There's always a sense of something still not quite there, something is missing, even if you're actually right there. So in our Zen practice, it's dropping the illusion of having the special significance and that there's something, somewhere, something that will fix this sense of impermanence, our insignificance, our suffering. So, you know, the dukkha, the no-self, impermanence. He also has a quote by Carl Jung about how to live. And he calls it the next most necessary thing. So this is in 1933. Carl Jung wrote to a respondent and she sort of asked him, you know, how should I live my life? And he says, "Dear Ravi, your questions are unanswerable because you want to know how to live. One lives as one can. There is no single definite way." And he says, you know, if you want someone to tell you how to live, you can join a church and they will tell you what to do. But he says the individual path is the way you make for yourself, which is never prescribed, which you do not know in advance, and which simply comes into being itself when you put one foot in front of the other. And so he says the way to walk this path is to quietly do the next and most necessary thing. And this really reminds me of a quote by Joko Beck that we have in our reading, where she says, "Zen is about an active life, an involved life. When we know our minds well and the emotions that our thinking creates, we tend to see better what our lives are about and what needs to be done, which is generally just the next task under our nose." Zen is about a life of action, not a life of passively doing nothing. But our actions must be based in reality. And so perhaps the art of meditation is that instead of having time or managing our time or using our time effectively, we just simply drop into being in time.